This is Science Friday. I'm Sophie Bushwick. I'm senior news editor at New Scientist, and I'm filling in for Ira Flatow this week while he's on vacation. Later in the hour, using DNA for data storage and computing, and we'll meet the Manhattan ant, a species of ant now taking Manhattan. But first, this Wednesday, an asteroid named 2024 RW1 burned up in the atmosphere above the Philippines. As asteroids go, it was pretty harmless, but astronomers are still excited about the event. Here to talk more about the impact is Science Friday's senior producer, Charles Berquist. Hi, Charles.
Hey, Sophie.
So tell me more about this asteroid.
Yeah, 2024 RW1 was an asteroid about a meter across, and as you said, it burned up in the atmosphere without doing any damage. This kind of asteroid really isn't that unusual. NASA says we get one of this size maybe every 2 weeks or so. There were some pictures that captured this particular impact from the ground, but a lot of the people in the Philippines probably didn't get to see it due to weather conditions because there was a typhoon Yagi, in the area at the time.
Wait, if it's not big and it didn't hurt anything and most people didn't even see it, then why do we care?
Yeah, so what was cool about this event is that astronomers with a project called the Catalina Sky Survey actually spotted it earlier in the day, like 8 hours earlier or so. And they were able to predict where and when it would be likely to enter the atmosphere. You know, we have a good handle on a lot of the bigger objects in space near us, but usually we only learn about the presence of these smaller near-Earth objects like this one after someone sees the fireball in the sky. The European Space Agency said it was just the ninth time that an asteroid like this had been spotted before impact, so this is a pretty unusual event.
And you have a related story about a human-made meteor shower?
That's right. You might recall the space mission called DART, the Double Asteroid Redirection Test. This was basically testing a possible planetary defense against these larger near-Earth objects. You know, if you slam something into an asteroid head-on, would it be possible to nudge it off its course and change its trajectory? So back in 2022, NASA sent this craft to slam into Dimorphos. This was a small moonlet orbiting the larger asteroid called Didymos. And they found that, yeah, they were able to change the trajectory of that smaller object. But it turns out that crash also kicked loose around 2 million pounds of debris and dust and rocks and stuff.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So this new study says some of that material could actually drift through space and make it to near Mars and the Earth in the next 10 to 20 years or so. And that would create a new meteor shower that folks could watch for. And they calculate there might be enough of this leftover debris to last for at least 100 years.
Very cool. Staying on the planetary sciences for a moment, there's new research into gold and earthquakes?
Yeah, so this is a cool one. So if you're hunting for gold, one of the things prospectors keep an eye out for is the mineral quartz. Areas that have veins of quartz are where you tend to find gold nuggets. Now, researchers say in the journal Nature Geoscience that that connection between gold and quartz might be due to the piezoelectric effect. And that's when stress on a crystal from bending or squeezing it can make electricity or vice versa. Quartz is a piezoelectric material, and the researchers say that the stress on the quartz from earthquakes could make enough electricity to cause aqueous gold, that's gold dissolved in the water, to deposit out of the solution in the rock. And the electricity could also help small particles of gold to clump up more gold over time and form larger nuggets or veins of gold within the quartz.
That is amazing. Wait, so could California's notoriously shaky ground maybe have helped produce the material for the gold rush?
So it definitely seems plausible, right, if earthquakes lead to gold nugget formation. But I'll note that the San Andreas Fault, you know, the big name fault in California itself, isn't normally associated with gold. And the main California gold rush deposits were like out in the Sierra Nevadas. So who knows?
I guess we'll have to go out there and start digging and try to figure it out.
That's right.
Looking for another kind of treasure, researchers may have identified a new kind of pain medication.
Yeah. So we all know that pain medications are a major challenge. There are, for minor pain, there's things like aspirin and ibuprofen and acetaminophen. But for serious pain, you're generally looking at things like the opioid drugs. There are millions of people that need those pain medications to control acute or chronic pain. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, those opioids have side effects and can pose risks of addiction and misuse. So I learned about this new drug from an article in Scientific American by Marla Broadfoot. The FDA has accepted for review a new kind of pain medication made by Vertex Pharmaceuticals. It's called suzetrigine, formerly known as VX-548. And this works in a new way by stopping up a sodium channel in the pain receptor neurons. It basically blocks the ability to transmit the pain signal. And if this drug is approved, it would be the first new way to treat pain in over 20 years. They're hoping to have a decision on this drug next year.
In other medical research news, there's efforts to see inside a living body. Tell me more.
Yeah, this one is earlier in the pipeline. So if you want to see inside the body, there are things like x-rays and MRI scans, but what if you could just look through the skin? Researchers report in the journal Science that they found if you take the right color dye and apply it to the skin of the mouse, the dye absorbs light in a way that it makes the skin scatter less light and can actually make it transparent to certain wavelengths.
Wow.
Yeah, they found that they could see things like blood vessels on the surface of the brain. They could see internal organs in the mouse's abdomen. And they could even watch peristalsis. That's the squishy muscle contractions that would move food through the digestive tract.
Ah, it's kind of gross, but very, very cool. I love it. So what's the magic ingredient here?
One thing I love about this story is that it's using the food coloring FD&C Yellow 5, which it turns out is the coloring that helps make Mountain Dew that bright yellow color,
Yeah. Or
bright yellow M&Ms and a bunch of other snack foods. The researchers say they aren't sure if the technique will work as well in humans because, you know, our skin is a lot thicker than mouse skin.
So I shouldn't be rubbing Mountain Dew on my hands to try to see through them?
Probably not. You might need to use like a lot more dye, or Okay. They'll have to find other ways to get the dye in there. But, you know, this is an intriguing start.
Okay, from a dye found in snack foods to a different sort of snack, there's a murder mystery at sea.
Yeah, so you know the line about how the big fish eats the little fish?
This
is pretty much that, but with a really, really big fish. Researchers had a satellite tracking tag on a pregnant shark called a poor beagle. These are not small. Like, this was about 7 feet long, hundreds of pounds. The satellite tags collect data like temperature and depth readings, and they're designed to pop off the shark after a while, and then they float up to the surface for researchers to collect. So in this case, the team got a signal from the tag that was on this pregnant poor beagle that the tag's been released and is floating near Bermuda. But after they collected it and read the data was weird. The log on the tracker showed that for months, the poor beagle swam at one depth during the day, another depth during the night. You can see the depth readings and the water temperature readings going up and down in the logs. But then, starting in March of 2021, there's this period of 4 days in the record where the tag keeps moving up and down in the water, but it stayed at a constant temperature, about 5 degrees warmer than the water, day and night. And then 4 days after that, the tag comes to the surface. So the only explanation that they can come up with is that the tag spent 4 days in the stomach of a larger predator before it was excreted.
Ah, do we know who done it?
So the researchers say either a white shark or a shortfin mako shark are the likely suspects because they're the only things that would be in the area at that time and the right size to go hunting for a poor beagle. But there's really no way to know.
And that's not the only ocean mystery this week.
Yeah, this next one is sad. You may have heard of Havaldimir. This is a male beluga whale that fishermen near northern Norway first noticed in 2019. This particular beluga seemed very used to humans, and he was found wearing a camera harness that was labeled Equipment St. Petersburg, which gave rise to the theory that he was an animal trained for military operations or spy work by Russia.
Okay.
Yeah, so Havaldimir stayed around Norway and Sweden after he was freed from his spy harness, and he would sometimes interact with people. He kind of became a tourist attraction around the area. It took him a while to really learn to hunt for food on his own, and sometimes he came too close to boats in the area. But last weekend, Havaldimir the beluga was found dead. While an official autopsy is yet to come, two animal rights groups have said he appeared to have sustained multiple gunshot wounds. So we'll have to wait and hopefully find out more about this sad case.
Yeah, that is sad. Well, I think we need to cheer up with some happier animal news. There's work out this week on pets playing fetch.
Yeah, so we all know many dogs like to play fetch. And if you talk to cat owners, they may tell you that their cats also like to play fetch too. Well, now scientists have published a paper quantifying just how fetchy both cats and dogs are. They surveyed over 8,000 cat owners and found that 41% reported that their cat would either sometimes, frequently, or always retrieve toys or objects that the owners threw, which is more than researchers previously thought. And it turns out all breeds of cats sometimes engage in fetching.
That's awesome. Yeah, I don't necessarily think of cats doing that, but I guess they enjoy it as much as dogs do.
Yeah, it turns out, you know, the numbers for dogs are higher. 78% of dog owners reported playing fetch with their dog. They said that the dog breeds that were developed to herd livestock or as hunting companions are more likely to play fetch than others. But, you know, all breeds showed some kind of fetching behavior.
So for the pet owners out there, which breeds of cats and dogs are more likely to have fun playing fetch?
Yeah, so again, all breeds of cats they found sometimes will play fetch, but it seemed to be more common in Burmese, Siamese, and Tonkinese cats. On the dog side, you're looking at Labrador and Golden Retrievers, Border Collies, English Cocker Spaniels, things like that.
That makes sense. I mean, Retriever is in the name for some of them.
Exactly. You would expect the Retriever to be good at fetch.
Yes, exactly.
And you know, in both cats and dogs, they found males are more likely to play fetch than females. Younger animals more likely to fetch than older animals are. They think that there may be some connection to learning hunting behavior or practicing hunting, but largely they found it's probably just fun.
I love that. And that's all the time we have for now. Thanks, Charles.
You're welcome, Sophie. Have a great weekend.
Charles Berquist is Science Friday's senior producer. After the break, how DNA molecules could be used for more than just encoding your physical traits, but for things like data storage and computing. We'll be right back after this short break. This is Science Friday. I'm Sophie Bushwick. Your genetic code contains a ton of data. It has all the instructions your body needs to develop, survive, and reproduce. And DNA is an incredibly compact way to store that information. Each one of our cells contains the equivalent of about a gigabyte of DNA data. That might not seem like too much. In comparison, it takes about 3 gigabytes to store a 2-hour movie. But with an estimated 30 trillion cells in our bodies, all that DNA adds up to roughly 30 trillion gigabytes, or 30 zettabytes of storage. That's enough to encode roughly 1/5 of all the data in the world today. In recent years, researchers have developed technologies that tap into DNA's storage capabilities. By converting genetic code into binary code, they can do things like encoding a book or even all of Wikipedia in the form of DNA base pairs. And now, researchers are going beyond storage and using DNA as the basis for computers. To explain more about this groundbreaking technology, I'm joined by two professors from North Carolina State University's Department of Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering, Dr. Albert Kyung and Dr. Orlin Velev. Welcome to Science Friday. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Sophie, for having us.
It is a pleasure to be on this very interesting discussion.
Thanks. And how does DNA store information?
The simplest way to think about it would be DNA is a string of letters, A, C, T, and G. And so you can have any length string of letters that you want, and you can have many of these strings. The simplest way to convert the letters into binary or zeros and ones would be an A could be a 00, a T could be a 01, a G could be a 10, and a C could be a 11. And so you just go letter by letter and convert that into these digits.
And what about if you want to go beyond storage and use DNA to process information as well? How does that work?
So this has actually been a relatively active field for over 20 years since Leonard Adleman first created the first computation with DNA. I mean, there's many different flavors of this computation. You could use enzymes that can recognize and chew up certain pieces of DNA that have certain sequences. There's types of computations that use interactions between different DNA molecules to bind or unbind each other and execute logical operations that way. So there's the past 2 decades have actually generated many creative versions of computation.
What about your work? What did your latest study focus on?
There's been 2 decades of work in DNA computation. And in parallel, but somewhat disjoint, there's been also work on storing information in DNA. What we wanted to do was create something that was compatible with both storing and computation, basically try to create a early full computer, something that we think could help spark, you know, the imagination of young scientists out there that might be thinking about getting into research and engineering and science. And so our focus was really on, can we create something that can both store, but it's also warm enough, kind of flexible enough to be used dynamically for things like computation.
Can you give an example of a computation that it could be used for?
Yeah. So one of the computations I found really fun was work over a decade ago from Princeton, where they computed a chess problem. And so this was one type of computation that we emulated, and then another was Sudoku. These puzzles are basically have kind of similar rules. So basically, it's asking, where can you put different chess pieces on a chessboard so that they don't attack each other or don't attack a certain piece? Or in Sudoku, where can you put 0s, 1s, 2s, 3s so that only one digit shows up in a row column at any one time, or every row, every column adds up to 6, things like that. So you have certain puzzles, certain board configurations that you're searching for.
And if we want to use DNA as a computer, it has to be able, like you said, to store this information and also process it. But some of the techniques you talked about for processing information, like using enzymes to chew up the DNA, that doesn't seem to be possible if you want to also store the DNA. So how did you get around that problem?
Exactly. I think that's kind of the disconnect that we were trying to find a solution for. So we needed a way to preserve and anchor the DNA without giving up its high density, information density, but also make it so that you can access the data and compute upon it without destroying the database. So this is where we linked up with Orlin Velov's group, who pioneered a nanomaterial that maybe he can tell you about. The key discovery was that DNA adhered to this material stably, but allowed enzymes to come in, make copies of the DNA into RNA, and then we could use that RNA to do computations without disturbing the original DNA.
Got it. So yes, I'd love to hear more about this nanomaterial.
It gives me a really pleasure to participate in this project because this is a really multidisciplinary investigation. Some time ago, we got together with my colleague Albert, and we were discussing how we can basically use the innovative nanomaterials that we make in my group and we study in order to manipulate and process DNA. And we had just come across this new material, which we call soft dendritic oids. It is a fibrillar material, which is made out of biopolymer, and it is branched. It has this hierarchical structure. So you have a thicker branch in the middle and then thinner and thinner branches, which come to be nanofibers all around. And nanofibers tend to be very sticky in physical perspectives. The reason gecko legs can run on any surfaces, that is, gecko lizards can run on any surfaces with their legs, is that they have these sticky mats of nanofibers. So it turned out that now our nanofibers in the new materials that we're making can be very sticky to DNA. Basically, we have a particle of fibrillar nature that can bind DNA. And in this way, we can immobilize the molecule. We can protect it in physical and mechanical sense. And we can even manipulate the whole cluster of DNA that has been collected by using magnetic particles, which are also included in the structure. So basically, while Albert has been providing the software, in a sense, we have been trying to provide a hardware that is going to allow the whole thing to be protected and manipulated.
When you describe the polymers as sort of like the tree branch with thinner and thinner pieces coming off it, it makes me picture the DNA sort of tangled up in a forest of trees, but on a very, very tiny scale. Is that an accurate way to think about it?
That is an interesting analogy. Well, if you think of a DNA as a delicate biological object, such as a bird, a tree is an ideal way to protect a bird in the sense that it can fly in. The branches will protect it, but then it can still go out. So basically, we have access to the inside, but we have protection from the inside when the molecule is hosted within this hierarchical structure. And the other thing that's important about hierarchical structures of this type is kind of a little bit more scientifically said. They have very high surface-to-volume ratio. So we use a small amount of material, but we create lots of surface area that is then available for DNA molecules to bind. So we do not use too much material, but we can bind lots of DNA on those particles. And as I mentioned, we can also add magnetic nanoparticles during the formation. So the whole cluster at the end is going to be magnetic.
Got it. I mean, and does that mean that I could plug a computer monitor into the DNA computer and it would theoretically run?
No, actually, yes. You would need an electronic interface, and the time scales of the operations would be very slow compared to what you're used to.
How slow?
On the order of probably a few hours to enter in a command and then get the result.
Okay. So what does this whole setup look like? If I've got my computer monitor, I'm waiting on the results, but what does the DNA computer part of this setup look like?
You probably will always need a electronic computer as an interface. And what it would do is basically act as an intermediary between a very high density DNA setup and database. It would basically process whatever data that you want from it and then display it so that a human could see it. The setup would look something like microfluidics. So you have either tiny, very thin, kind of capillary-like tubing, or it could be microfluidics. That's what we used in this work, but you could also create microfluidic devices that are like little chips that have very small, narrow channels inside. You could put different databases within these channels and flow basically different solutions containing your enzymes or just water through these channels in order to make copies or execute computations, access the data that you want. You would then flow, say, the RNA copies of the data that you want out of the nanomaterial that's linked to the DNA. The RNA would come out of that and flow into what we call a sequencer. There are several different technologies. The one that we use is called an Oxford nanopore. So those RNA molecules would then flow through the nanopore and give off different electrical signals as it passes through that pore, and those signals would correspond to the different letters, and you would get that readout that would get sent to your computer.
And I know that DNA is a very compact way of storing information. I mean, each one of our cells has about 2 meters of it, and then it's compressed into just about 6 microns. So how much smaller could we make our computers if they use DNA for some of this data storage and processing?
Yeah, so theoretically, if you do what's called freeze drying of the DNA, meaning you basically evaporate all of the water away and you're left only with the DNA, it can be very, very compact. You could literally store all of the world's information in a square foot.
And if I can go back to the material aspects of this work, DNA can store lots of information, but it is also a delicate molecule, and it is easy to encode material to encode information in DNA, but not that easy to then find the right molecule and pull it out of the rest. So that's why you also need the materials component, which is how do we protect, immobilize, move around, sort out the DNA. So that's what makes this research hopefully interesting, is that it really has all those informatics aspects and molecular and materials and electronics even.
That's a really good point, because we think about data storage. I mean, I know that it doesn't last forever. A USB drive might only work reliably for, you know, a decade or less. So as a computer and as a storage method, how does DNA compare to other forms of data storage? How long can it preserve itself?
One of the really main drivers of the DNA storage field has been not only the incredible information density, but the longevity. There's been fossils that have been discovered, that are 1 million years old, and people have been able to extract DNA from it. I think that there's caveats to that, in that the DNA is degraded and you aren't able to access all of the DNA in a pristine condition. However, very simple storage methods can preserve the DNA for 1 million years. This is one of the key advantages of molecular storage. Theoretically, store DNA for thousands of millions of years at near room temperature or in like a household freezer without having to expend very much energy to do that. In comparison, a lot of electronic media, like you mentioned, a USB stick, or a lot of the long-term storage media like tape, magnetic tape, these are actually not very stable. I think we often think about inorganic materials as very robust and hardy, right? But they actually have a lot of defects actually just coming out of the manufacturing plants, and a lot of these defects are engineered around in your devices. And over a few years, radiation that naturally comes from space can degrade your devices, just wear and tear from heat, oxidation. And so even the tape storage that's used for long-term archival storage of data, those often you need to copy the material every 5 to 10 years onto a new tape reel. And you have to repeat that every 5 to 10 years.
And you've said that DNA could revolutionize computing. What do you see this tech being used for?
I do not really see it as, replacing your laptops or personal computing. But I think that there's a lot of things that are important for our everyday, economy and society that rely on computing in the background that we don't know about, we don't see. So things that are happening at data centers, these really large buildings with massive energy, land footprints, that are executing computations for us. So even when we do like a Google search flight, where is that computation happening? It's not actually happening on your computer. It's off somewhere else. And there's a lot of these large scale computations that are really important for industry, for academic research. And I think DNA could be very powerful for those types of processes where you need to make very, very complicated and demanding calculations that require a lot of storage, but also parallelized computation.
Yes, if I may add a little bit of different angle away from informatics, the ability to store and manipulate and deliver DNA and RNA can also find applications in other areas, such as drug delivery, vaccines, plant treatments. So really kind of like combining materials and informatics in this case, really have lots of potential future implications, which are still to be understood probably.
And what about the two of you? Where do you see your research heading now?
Oh, in so many directions. We actually have a couple projects that are still ongoing related to just the properties in DNA as a material itself, as well as other types of materials that the VELIV group has been pioneering and how that interacts with DNA, whether we can protect it for millennia at room temperature, for example. There's a lot of fundamental questions as well that just about how these materials work at the nanoscale that that we're also interested in.
I can say that we have been really very inspired by what we have learned from Albert's group, in the sense that there are different methods for manipulation of particles on the nanoscale, and sorting out in microfluidic devices, that was mentioned, but we have been interested also in external fields, electrical fields especially. So this has been really a very productive collaboration in terms of combining ideas from different areas and finding out interesting new applications for both DNA and nanoscience.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Sophie, for having us.
Thank you.
Those were North Carolina State University's Department of Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering professors, Dr. Albert Kyung and Dr. Orlin Velev. After the break, meet New Jersey's shark fishermen who prioritize conservation. This is Science Friday. I'm Sophie Bushwick. And now it's time to check in on the state of science.
This is KERA
for WWNO,
St. Louis Public Radio,
KQED Iowa News. Public Radio News.
Local science stories of national significance. Sharks face a lot of challenges in our modern world. There's climate change, of course, and then there's overfishing. Unless you live on a coast, it might surprise you to learn that shark fishing is alive and well. But it's not always a bad thing. An increasing number of shark fishermen are chasing sharks with the goal of conservation. My next guest tagged along with a conservation-oriented shark fisherman in New Jersey. He joins me now to talk about it. Alan Yu, reporter for WHYY and The Pulse, based in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Alan, you got to go on a trip chasing sharks at the Jersey Shore. Tell me about that experience. What was it like?
So one shark fisherman told me beforehand, and I think it captures it perfectly, is that for a long time, nothing happens. And then everything happens at once in the space of a few minutes. So we waited for everyone to clear the beach first. So there was no one in the water, no one on the boat. So no humans in the water. And then there was a lot of setup because they need to have really sturdy fishing rods that can handle a shark because sharks can weigh hundreds of pounds. And then there are some lines that the shark fisherman AJ manually casts. And then there are some lines that he actually uses a drone to fly offshore so he can cast them further out. And then once those are set up, you basically just wait. Every time you see a line shaking, AJ will sprint across the sand to see if there's something at the other end. And we got a few bites every now and then. Sometimes a shark would bite half a fish and then leave the other half. But it took more than 3 hours before we caught a shark. But once we had a bite, then it made for like an action-packed 1 minute.
And to me, it just seems a little counterintuitive that fishermen are catching sharks with the intent to save them. So can you explain that to me?
Yeah, so the fisherman I went out with, AJ, says that he likes to catch sharks because of the challenge. And he likes to do it from a beach because he can get right up next to a shark. Whereas if he did it from a boat, he would be looking down on them. And he says that that contact makes him appreciate and respect sharks more because it's so hard to catch one. When he was starting out more than 10 years ago, he said that he would spend multiple days on a beach before he could catch a shark. And so he really respects these as apex predators that are not easy to catch. He's very committed to doing catch and release fishing. So he says that he does everything he can to make sure that the sharks are not harmed and that they experience the least stress possible. And we have a clip of him saying that.
You just want the fish to survive. That's the end of the story. The point is, for this to be a sustainable fishery, you need to have fish swimming off and living a happy life after the encounter.
And the other thing is that shark anglers like AJ, they also work with shark researchers because the people who are fishing for sharks are often out there far more often than the researchers are. And so it's a convenient way to get sharks and then the researchers can tag them, sample them, and then release the sharks back out again. And AJ does work regularly with a shark researcher at Monmouth University in New Jersey.
AJ said that it's good to have the sharks living a happy life after the encounter. So how are shark populations doing in that region?
The research shows that shark populations are rebounding in the northeastern U.S. and in the Atlantic Ocean, but quite a few species are still endangered, so they're not quite as endangered, but you know that they are making a bit of a comeback, at least in the Atlantic.
And what about conservation biologists? Do they have any thoughts about this new twist on shark fishing?
Yes, they do. So first of all, it's certainly an improvement over the past when people would fish for sharks like it was a trophy hunt. I talked to a professor of fish conservation, Andy Danochuk, who remembers going out to piers in the 1970s and seeing dead bodies of sharks being hung up as actual trophies. That has long passed now, and most people who fish for sharks do catch and release like AJ does. So Andy Danochuk, he likes shark fishing himself, and he became interested in conservation partly because he liked shark fishing. Here's some tape of him.
But then the more that I fished and then the more that I was observant of what was going on in the environment, I started to realize that in order for us to have a future for being able to fish for these animals, we need to think about how we can use science to better inform their conservation and management.
So the research focus now is actually working with the shark anglers to make sure that they do what they can to make sure that sharks can survive being caught and that they're not harmed by it. Because even though people like AJ will do whatever they can to minimize the stress, it is still stressful for a shark to be yanked out of the water for a minute before they get put back in.
I know a lot of people who like to fish, but not everyone is fishing for sharks. And then you have recreational activities like diving, where people do want to see sharks, and then surfing, where they don't. Which is to say that there's a lot of interaction between people and sharks, whether it's wanted or not, or intentional or not. Do scientists think we could all live in harmony?
I think yes, but it's a complicated way to reach that. Andy Nanochuk talked about this. He said that because you have people with these competing and overlapping interests, and you can't control the sharks, right? All you can do is control the people. And so that's why he says that he sees his work in fish conservation as much as a social science as it is a science, because he can study the sharks, he can see where they are, but then at the end of the day, it's about figuring out how do you work with the people who are interacting with the sharks in one way or the other so that you can protect the shark populations, but then people can also still get to do the fishing that they like to do.
Alan Yu, reporter for WHYY and The Pulse, based in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on as always.
New York City is home to more than 8 million people, but below our feet, there's another massive population, ants. They're in our sidewalk cracks, our flower beds, even our apartments. Despite the many ants going about their business in urban areas, they've remained pretty understudied. So scientists got a big surprise in 2011 when they discovered a new ant in town, and on Broadway, no less, lovingly dubbed the Manhattan Ant. Insect ecologists finally know more about this little ant in the big city, thanks to my next guest, Dr. Clint Pennick, assistant professor of insect ecology at Auburn University in Alabama. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Sophie. Happy to be here.
You've recently identified this ant, and it's not a brand new species. So what do we know about it?
Well, we found out that the Manhattan ant traveled to New York City via Europe. Like several of the other ant species that we have in Manhattan, they're immigrants, just like many of the immigrants that came to the city through multiple waves.
And how unusual is it to discover a new type of insect in an urban area like this?
It might not be as unexpected as you would think. We actually have a better handle on a lot of natural spaces that scientists have been working in for many years than we do with our own cities. Our group was actually the first over a decade ago to study the biodiversity of ants in New York City. No one in the history of the city had ever thought to do that before.
Wow.
But people have actually, you know, looked at natural places and stuff outside the city.
And I've seen pictures of you collecting data in the city, and I have to ask about your method. It kind of looks like you're sucking up ants with a straw. So tell me more about that.
So we have this special device that we call it an aspirator, which is basically a mouth vacuum. So it has a tube that you put in your mouth, and then it's attached to a vial with a little filter in it, so the ants don't go in your mouth. And then we point it like a little gun at ants on the sidewalk and then inhale, and that's how it works.
And what have we learned about New York's ants from this?
So I originally began working in New York City to understand what ants are eating. How do they survive and thrive in a habitat that basically looks like a concrete jungle? And what I found is that the main ants that we see on the sidewalk, the most common ones, survive because we're sloppy, basically. So we drop food, we spill things, and the ants clean it up. They're basically the unpaid garbage workers of New York City. But the new ant that showed up, the Manhattan ant, is different. And so that's one of the questions that my lab is trying to figure out now, is how they are able to survive on these sidewalks, because what we do know is that they don't seem to be eating human foods.
Can you give me an example of some of the human foods they're eating?
Oh, well, I mean, the classic one we always go to is hot dogs, because it's New York City, there's hot dog stands.
Yeah.
And we've actually done some sort of back of the envelope calculations to figure out how many hot dogs the ants just living on Broadway in New York City eat every year. and it's 60,000. The ants eat the equivalent of 60,000 hot dogs a year.
That's wild. But the Manhattan ants aren't doing this. So how are they establishing themselves?
Yeah, we don't exactly know yet what the Manhattan ants are doing to survive. But what we seem to think that they're doing is that when we see them foraging, they're climbing up trees that are planted along the sidewalk. And so whatever they're eating is in the canopy of these trees. And so there's bugs and other insects that are up there. And some of them produce this substance, this sugary substance that's called honeydew. And so these are insects that feed on plant fluids. And then basically their poop is sugar. And that's what the ants, we think, are eating.
So the insects that do that, this is reminding me of another invasive species, the spotted lanternfly. Is that something that produces honeydew?
Yes, exactly. So New Yorkers now are pretty familiar with the sight of these pink and purple lanternflies, which are really beautiful, but are really troubling and invasive. And so lanternflies, yeah, they do. They feed on plant tissues and they produce honeydew. And we've actually seen Manhattan ants interacting with them. So now we have this sort of mix of species that, you know, from all over the world that are coming together. And I guess, you know, much like humans are sharing their culinary culture and exchanging foods. hopefully it turns out good for the human residents in New York. But yeah, they definitely interact with lantern flies.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious about what you think the result would be of this kind of interaction.
This is something that ants have evolved to do in a number of different contexts. But when they feed on honeydew produced by something like lanternflies, the ants obviously are getting food from this mutualism. What they give back to the insects is protection. So ants can basically serve as the bouncers and bodyguards for honeydew-producing insects like lanternflies. So if this continues, and especially if the Manhattan ant spreads out of New York City, as it's already starting to do, and makes it into agricultural areas where lanternflies are more of a pest, it's possible that these ants could be protecting lanternflies and helping them develop larger populations.
So that's not good. We're supposed to be stomping on lanternflies, not helping them. So, I mean, is there anything we can do to prevent Manhattan ants from doing that?
Well, right now, we're just trying to keep an eye on them. When we discovered them, they were pretty rare. We found them in a couple kind of deep forested areas of parks in New York City, kind of tucked in dark parts of Central Park. But what we found is that they're actually thriving. They're able to move into the most urban areas of the city. And so we really don't know how their populations are going to impact native species or other invasive species like lanternflies. So over time, we've realized that they've become more prominent than we would have guessed at the beginning. And my lab is focused on tracking their populations and trying to tease apart what their effects could be. And one way people could help is that we actually created a project through iNaturalist called Project Manhattan Ant. And on that site, you can take pictures of ants that you think are Manhattan ants and upload them. And then that helps us track their populations and see where they are.
What do they look like for people who are going on a hunt for this kind of ant?
Yeah, to me, I always tell people that they're kind of big, but they're not really that big. So to an ant person, they're bigger than a lot of ants, but they're kind of a medium-sized ant. But the characteristic that can help someone ID them is that they're red and black. And they're the only ant of that size in New York City and really through much of the Northeast that you'll commonly see that's red and black. They have a black head and a black abdomen, and then their thorax is red.
And you've also mentioned the native species of ant that was found in Manhattan before these ants moved in. So what is the most common ant in the city?
Yeah, so Manhattan is quite diverse. There's a lot of ant species there. We've actually documented over 40 different species of ants just in Manhattan alone, which is more than has been found in the nearest protected area outside the city. So by all measures, New York City is quite diverse when it comes to ants. The most common ant in New York is, like the Manhattan ant, is not native. It's called the pavement ant. They're also from Europe. But they've been there much, much longer. So the pavement ants probably came to New York City in some of the early waves of immigrants. They've at least been there 100 years, potentially longer. But they've kind of been adopted as naturalized residents, like many New Yorkers, like many different people who come to New York. They live mostly on the sidewalks. They're not a huge pest. They don't get in people's homes. But they're the ones up until the last 10 years or so that have dominated the sidewalks of New York City.
And how are these species interacting? Do they seem to get along okay?
We don't know that yet, but we do know is that when they do meet each other, they sometimes fight. So we've seen the Manhattan ant tearing apart some pavement ants, and probably the opposite happens as well. So right now, it could just be, you know, a battle for the streets to see which ant comes on top.
And learning about this overlooked activity is making me think of a great line from your paper about these ants. You wrote, "Often the only visual non-humans in Times Square are humans dressed as Disney animals. And yet, hidden in this flower pot was a whole society of animal beings."
Yeah, so this is something that really surprised me. As someone, I mean, I've been working in New York City on ants for the better part of a decade, and where we work tends to be in the Upper West Side or in some of the park habitats. But I went with my student, Samantha Kennett, and we decided to look in the most dense, the most urban part of the city, which is Times Square. And sure enough, all we had to do was peek inside a flower pot, and we found a full colony of the Manhattan thriving, you know, in the midst of, you know, thousands of people who were probably there already. And yeah, and like what we wrote in the paper as sort of, you know, a tongue-in-cheek joke, but, you know, there's all these characters dressed up as animals in Times Square, but the only animal besides us humans were the Manhattan ants, and they seem to be doing quite well.
And I wanted to get back to the citizen science aspect of this. We know that we want to stop invasive species, so that involves stomping on lanternflies. We know that we want to learn more about the Manhattan ant, and you've got that project on iNaturalist. Do you have any other advice for folks who might want to get involved in ant hunting?
Yeah, I mean, ants are one of the easiest things to find. I mean, whether you want to find them or not, they end up in your kitchen. They end up, you know, on our sidewalks. And so, yeah, I do ask people, just pay attention. There's a lot of species. We have, you know, something like 800 species of ants that are native to the United States. And like I said, 40 of them are in our biggest and densest city. So if you can get out there and take some photos of them and upload them to iNaturalist, we would certainly appreciate it.
That's all the time we have for now. I'd like to thank my guest, Dr. Clint Pennock, Assistant Professor of Insect Ecology at Auburn University in Alabama. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
And that's all the time we have for today. Lots of folks helped make this show happen this week, including
Annie Nero,
Jason Rosenberg,
Rasha Aridi,
Shoshana Buxbaum.
Thanks, everyone. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. If you missed any part of this program or would like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts or ask your smart speaker to play Science Friday. I'm Sophie Bushwick. This is Science Friday. I'm Sophie Bushwick, senior news editor at New Scientist. I'm filling in for Ira this week. Later in the hour, a neuroscientist investigates what we know about cow intelligence and how scientists can learn about really ancient history by looking at rocks. Up first, kids across the U.S. just kicked off a new school year, but the summer heat is still here. In recent years, temperatures have stayed hotter than normal through September and even into October. And sitting in a sweltering classroom can make learning really difficult, even dangerous. A story in The 19th describes how learning and teaching have become more challenging as the planet heats up, and what solutions might be on the horizon. Joining me is Jessica Kutz, reporter at The 19th, based in Tucson, Arizona. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks so much, Sophie.
Jessica, why are kids specifically so at risk for heat exhaustion or dehydration?
Yeah, so kids are so at risk because their bodies are still developing the ability to thermoregulate. And what that means is that, you know, our bodies have this ability to either heat up or warm up when it's too cold or to cool down when it's too hot outside. But for kids, their main ability and our main ability to thermoregulate in the heat is the function of sweating. But kids don't sweat as much as adults. And that's really important because when we sweat, that evaporates off of our skin and it cools us down. It's kind of one of our main mechanisms in the heat. And so for kids, also for people who are pregnant and also the elderly, that ability is somewhat compromised. I would say the other thing is that kids, they also just haven't learned the cues of their own bodies yet. So they don't always know when they're overheating or they forget to drink water when they should be drinking water. And so they really depend on adults like parents and teachers to remind them to do these sorts of things to stay safe.
And some schools can just run the AC during hot weather, but many don't have air conditioning, right?
That's right. So as you mentioned, heat is extending further into the school year, but it's also starting earlier into the spring. So this used to not be a problem because, you know, in places like the East Coast, where there really isn't air conditioning in a lot of these schools because they were built in like the 50s and the 60s, they didn't have to think about having cooling because kids were already out of schools in the summer when it started to get hotter. But because this heat season is extending, we have a lot of students that are in these classrooms that don't have any air conditioning. And in contrast, like where I live in Tucson and Arizona in general, it's always been pretty hot here. And so schools have already adapted to the hot weather, but a lot of parts of the country don't have that infrastructure yet.
Roughly how many schools would you say don't have AC in the country?
So the latest estimate shows that over 36,000 schools nationwide don't have adequate cooling or HVAC systems. So that's a pretty large number. They estimate that it would cost about $4.5 billion to upgrade schools or to just even like bring in air conditioning in the first place.
As part of your reporting, you spoke with teachers. How are they feeling about this problem?
Teachers are feeling pretty frustrated, I learned. Mm-hmm. I spoke to a teacher in Pennsylvania and another in New York. And so they're really like at the kind of epicenter of this issue. And they're frustrated because their job has become, as much as it is about the learning and the teaching their students, it's also become a lot about the safety and having to like be aware of how their kids are doing in the classroom. And then also having to like deal with all these added distractions because of that. So one teacher I spoke to in Pennsylvania, she's in Pittsburgh, her classroom was getting up to like 90 degrees, which is very hot. It's too hot for anyone to be in all day. So they started allowing water bottles so that kids could drink water during the day. But then that means kids have to go to the bathroom and they're spilling the water. And, you know, it's like creating this whole other host of distractions when you have like 30 kids now who are all needing to like drink water and take care of themselves. And it was kind of funny when I talked to one of the teachers in New York. Yeah, he was saying kids are really lethargic. They are tired. And they also, in his classroom, they would put their heads down on their desk because the desk is cool. It's like a cool surface. So you have kids like essentially falling asleep on these cool surfaces, just trying to stay like a comfortable temperature. And yeah, and it's really hard to teach in that kind of environment and for students to learn.
What about other solutions? Are there other ways that schools and teachers can keep students cool?
Yeah, I mean, the best one is just upgrading these schools so that they have air conditioning. Another teacher I spoke to said that he does like close the blinds or he'll turn off the lights. And actually in New York, the state legislature just passed a law. It's waiting for the governor's signature, but it would require exactly that. So when it's 82 degrees inside a classroom, it would require teachers to close blinds, turn off the lights. And then when it gets to 88 degrees, classes would have to be canceled. So now when schools are canceled because of heat, they can kind of revert back to remote learning. We know that has its own issues too, like some, you know, kids are then home alone and might not have the same like capacity to learn from home.
You've mentioned how teachers are taking on a lot more in terms of safety. I wanted to mention that tragically, there was a school shooting in Georgia earlier this week on September 4th. Two students and two teachers were killed. According to CNN, that's the 45th school shooting in the U.S. so far this year. So how does that safety concern intersect with trying to keep kids safe from heat?
Yeah, so this was something, it's just like an unfortunate reality of schools over the last few decades with school shootings, you know, something that schools and teachers used to be able to do before this started happening was they would leave windows open overnight, or they would leave doors open throughout the school to create like a cross breeze. And once they started having to kind of take these heightened security measures because of things like school shootings, all those options to kind of naturally cool down a school completely evaporated with school shootings and, you know, the need to keep students safe from this other very real danger during the school year.
Mm-hmm. Let's switch gears a little bit. Do we know how heat and being in these hot conditions affects kids' ability to learn and even to just show up to class?
Yeah. So, you know, as I mentioned before, the classroom is just a lot more distracting for learning. There are a lot of studies that show like lower abilities to concentrate and to take in information when temperatures are higher. There was one pretty robust one. It was published in 2020, and researchers analyzed the PSAT scores of 10 million students in the country. And so they looked at students who had like higher exposure to heat during the school year compared to those who didn't. And they found that for every degree hotter a school year was, it resulted in a 1% decrease in learning.
Mm-hmm. You've mentioned some state-level guidelines for what schools should do on hot days. Which states have regulations like that?
Arizona is, I would kind of say, like a leader in this area, just because, as I mentioned, they've been dealing with this for a number of years. So in 2017, they created a heat-ready plan for schools in Phoenix. And what that does is it just creates like a series of guidelines that schools have to follow when it hits certain temperatures. Again, some of those are like moving around recess or not having recess if it's too hot outside, you know, taking different measures to keep the classrooms cool. In California, they're also trying to pass a new bill that would also create a similar heat action plan. But one of the kind of issues at the moment that policymakers are pointing out is that there isn't any sort of federal guidance that could help schools maybe like make these plans more quickly or like have some sort of, you know, understanding of like what is a temperature that's too hot for students or what should we be aiming for. So there is an effort to ask the Department of Education to start creating some sort of federal guideline that schools could look to.
So would you say there's groups actively trying to get some federal guidelines in place? Because the fact that we don't have those sounds pretty concerning, especially yeah. with temperatures rising. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like so many things right now related to extreme heat is we're kind of behind the ball a bit in so many different areas of this country and in our infrastructure, and schools is of course one of those. So there are some like different think tanks that are trying to put pressure on the federal government. That includes the Center for American Progress, the Federation of American Scientists, and a few others that all signed this letter really urging lawmakers or urging the government to start thinking more deeply about this issue and trying to bring some urgency to it. Because as you mentioned, every year has been hotter than like the year before. So it's not like a future problem that we have to solve. Schools, even this year already, have had to cancel or have an early dismissal for class because it's just too hot for their students. So we're already seeing a loss of learning. It's just like so many things related to extreme heat. I don't think the country has been taking it seriously enough. And it's just now starting to kind of reach this point where people are starting to pay attention to it.
Before we go, Jessica, is there anything parents can do at home to keep their kids safe when they go off to school?
Yeah, there's a few things they could do. So one, definitely, as we were talking about, like take, you know, make sure your child has a water bottle that they can take to school. There are water bottles that are insulated or they're steel, and so they keep water cold, which is really helpful. Another tip is like dress your children in loose fitting, light colored clothes. That also keeps them cooler. And then if they do have like a health issue or health concern like asthma or some other concern that makes them more susceptible to heat, they can talk to their teachers and their schools. Most schools do have like a portable AC unit that they can bring into a classroom. But sometimes it means like there has to be a request. So, you know, a parent has to let the teacher know that their student has this health condition. And so usually they can bring in some sort of portable unit to at least help those students.
Jessica, thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Jessica Kutz is a reporter at the 19th News. After the break, a neuroscientist sits down to talk about his new book called Cow Puppy and why cows are smarter than you may think. This is Science Friday. I'm Sophie Bushwick. If you've ever seen a cute cow video on social media, you might notice they seem to have a lot in common with dogs. They can wag their tails, they love to gobble down some tasty treats, and if you're lucky, they can flop over for a nice belly or neck scratch. They're clearly curious animals. But how smart are they exactly? That's the question that neuroscientist and author Dr. Gregory Burns had when he and his wife moved from Atlanta to the Georgia countryside in 2020 and started raising cows of their own. To better understand them, he applied his years of experience researching the brains of animals like dogs and dolphins. He joins us now to talk about his new book. It's called Cow Puppy, An Unexpected Friendship and a Scientist's Journey into the Secret World of Cows. Dr. Burns, welcome back to Science Friday.
Hey, Sophie. Great to be here.
So I love the title of the book, Cow Puppy. Can you tell us the story behind that word and how you got started raising cows?
Yeah, I'm fond of the title, too. So I ended up on this farm back in 2020 and without kind of a clear idea of exactly what I was going to do, other than I had this vague notion that I was going to grow vegetables and live sustainably. And of course, I would have to have animals because being a dog person and general animal person, what's a farm without animals?
Right.
And I didn't know exactly what I was going to get. And pretty soon found myself with a bull and two cows, which I got primarily just to manage the grass because we had all these pastures and the idea kind of morphed into this, well, the cows will eat the grass, I'll collect their manure, we'll compost it, then we'll turn it into the food garden, then we'll grow all these great fruits and vegetables and, you know, we'll eat some, we'll sell some at the farmer's market and it would just be wonderful.
So they would contribute to having a sustainable farm?
That's right. So my original idea was just to kind of use them as biological reactors, not as food products themselves, but just to help with the farm management or partners in the enterprise, shall we say.
Got it.
And so I can't kind of overemphasize how little I knew about cows, which was probably about the same as what most people knew, which is you see them from the side of the road and they seem kind of almost inert and sedate and pretty easygoing, at least until you get up close to them and you realize how big most of them are. But that aside, the cows turned out to be pregnant and the person I got them from dropped them off and informed me that I would have a surprise very soon, which was in fact about 2 weeks after I got them when our first calf was born. You know, so talk about rapid learning curve, then that kind of
sure
throws you into it. And then the other one calved about 2 weeks later. And once that happened, I kind of fell in love with them. Partially just from watching them, how they behaved with each other, just watching how the mamas tended to their babies and how the babies latched on and bonded so quickly and how fast they grew up and frankly, how playful these calves were. And so one in particular turned out to be very playful and very affectionate and kind of very outgoing, both, you know, with the other cows, but also with me. And so I kind of jokingly said, He behaves like a puppy, so I started calling my cow puppy.
And a lot of your past research involved studying animal brains and asking questions like, do dogs feel emotions the same ways we do? What level of intelligence do they have? As a researcher, what were your initial big questions when you started living with cows?
Well, I hadn't had kind of too much thought or experience into what cows, you know, might experience. I mean, we have an advantage with dogs in the sense that one, they've evolved with us for a long period of time, but also many people have firsthand experience where dogs share our lives. You know, they sleep at our feet or sometimes they sleep in our beds. And so we kind of come to understand their body language and how they behave. And we recognize their emotions. And much of my previous work was kind of studying the neural basis of some of those feelings that they had. And so I didn't really know what to expect with cows because I hadn't had any firsthand experience. And yet the more I observed them, the more similar I saw them to be to dogs in many ways. That they, you know, it became very clear that they, that first off, they have a capacity for emotion. And in fact, in many ways, they're more demonstrative than dogs are in how they show affection both with each other and with me. And the difference with the cows is that any relationship that I formed with them was kind of much more hard earned than with dogs. Because I say that dogs are easy. They kind of come out ready to be everyone's friends. But cows, of course, come from a very different evolutionary trajectory where they evolved from animals that were preyed upon and have kind of this natural wariness of anything that comes into their environment. And so when they accept you into their group, it's really special, and they're frankly very loyal once they do.
And you found early in your cow journey that there's not a lot of existing research on cow intelligence or social behavior. What do you make of that?
There's been a fair amount of research around cattle, both beef cattle and dairy cattle, but the vast majority of it is from a production standpoint. So researchers have looked at things that produce more milk or put on more weight for cows. And so it's kind of all been geared towards that. And there just hasn't been the amount of attention given to what we now do with dogs, especially, and trying to really understand what their cognition is like. How do cows think, and what is their emotional capacity, and how do they represent these feelings that they have?
And if that was studied more, do you think it would be helpful for understanding animal intelligence more broadly?
I think every species we look at, we have to kind of take on its own, if you will. So I think this has been kind of a flaw in a lot of animal research in the past, mainly kind of coming from the top down, where we always tend to resort to human metrics of intelligence. And this, of course, is problematic when you're studying other species because, you know, until we start probing it, who's to say what it means to be an intelligent cow or a not so intelligent cow? And why should it even be surprising that you might have some that are smarter than each other? So we have to map these things out.
What surprising things did you learn about cows' brains, and how do they compare to human brains?
Well, so if you look at a cow's brain, and I have using MRI, probably the most surprising thing about it is how folded it is, or what we call gyrification. And so, you know, we know with human brains, they're very folded, and everyone has seen pictures of that. A dog brain, in comparison, is not nearly as folded. And yet the cow, which most people would not consider as intelligent as a dog, even though that, I think that's a silly comparison, and yet the cow has kind of this more folded, more gyrified cortex. Now, what that means is a matter of debate. You know, some people for decades have been saying that the more folded a brain is, the more tissue is in there and the more capacity for different types of intellectual and cognitive function there is. Mm-hmm. That may be. You know, I have found them to be more intelligent than dogs in many ways.
Yeah. Can you get into in what ways were they more intelligent?
So I think the most dramatic demonstration of intelligence that I had was something called the mirror test. So the mirror test is perhaps one of the most famous tests of supposedly self-awareness in the animal world. And the idea is you put a mirror in front of a person or an animal or an infant, and do they recognize their reflection as themselves? This is a huge deal in science. Perhaps with the exception of humans, perhaps only chimpanzees and maybe dolphins have demonstrated that they understand that the reflection is them. A dog, for example, typically either ignores their reflection or barks at it. They show no recognition or even, frankly, how to use a mirror. We take this for granted. You look at a mirror, you know that the things in the mirror are reflections and represent things behind you, not necessarily on the other side of the mirror. So what I did, and nobody had done this before, was I put up a giant mirror in my pasture. I lashed it to the fence, and I just left it there for months because you have to give animals enough time to explore and learn at their own pace. And initially, the cows were just, they were entranced by it. They would spend many hours, you know, just staring at the reflections. And sometimes they would look behind it to try to figure it out. And then what was amazing, over time, several of them seemed to figure out how to use the mirror in a very functional way. When some other cow came up behind them while they were looking in the mirror and they saw that reflection, they understood to turn around and look behind them.
Wow.
Which to me is quite remarkable because I've never seen a dog do that.
And something else that I learned from your book is how cows use licking as a social behavior. Can you explain why licking is so important to them?
Yeah. So, you know, this is not uncommon in the animal world. I mean, dogs lick, cats lick, but why they do it is a matter of debate. You know, some people say they do it to groom each other and get off parasites, but what cows do is they use it as a form of affection and social bonding. And so it's actually very interesting and very stereotypical when a cow wants to be licked, they will kind of sidle up to another one. They'll put their head down a little bit and then they'll waggle it from side to side, essentially saying, please lick me. And then the other one will start licking their neck. And then the first one might stretch out their head a little bit. And it actually mimics a position that calves do when they're nursing the udder from below. And it's what we call a neotenous behavior, which is a juvenile behavior that gets retained into adulthood, which turns out to be very common in animals as ways to show affection. And I think the way to think about it is these are what some people have called soothing signals. They're a way that the animals calm themselves and reinforce their bonds with each other. And they'll do it to me too.
Huh. I'd also like to look at the downside of cattle. We know that cows produce a lot of the greenhouse gas methane through their burps and farts, and they also require a lot of resources. So a big chunk of agriculture and land in the U.S. is dedicated exclusively to growing grain and corn for cows to consume. You've spent a lot of time with cattle ranchers over the past few years. What do you think are some ways that this system could be set up differently to reduce our environmental and ethical concerns?
Yeah, it's a difficult problem because especially in the United States, our agricultural system, especially when it comes to meat, is very centralized. So most people raising cattle tend to raise it on their farmland. And then when the animal gets to a certain weight, they sell it at auction. And then the animal gets shipped usually to the Midwest, where they're so-called finished on industrialized farms. So part of the environmental impact is the original land that they're grazing, but also the environmental impact of those large factory farms where they're finished in the last couple of weeks of their life, where they're fed large amounts of grain. Now, cows can eat grain, although that is not what they evolved to eat. They are ruminants, meaning they are evolved to eat grass, and they have very unique digestive systems that are well suited to that. And so when it comes to the methane emissions, for example, it's definitely a case of what goes in comes out. And so when you pump in a lot of these high-value carbohydrates, the fermentation that happens in the process of the cow, that's what generates the methane. And so one way to mitigate that is stop feeding them grain. So, I mean, apart from changing the feed, I mean, all of this is driven by people's dietary habits. And so then, of course, probably the biggest thing that people can do is cut down on their consumption of meat.
And something you write about as well is the way that these cows seem to have an almost therapeutic effect when you spend extended amounts of time with them. What did you learn about that and the effect it also had on your neighbors?
That's right. So as I said, I mean, my cows are here to help me manage the pasture. That was their original purpose. But as I fell in love with them and they fell in love with me, I found them to be very relaxing and grounding in a way that I hadn't found any other animal. And so what I started doing as kind of a daily routine is I would just sit down with them when they were lying down in the pasture, chewing their cud. Eventually, I was able just to sit with them and rest with them, lean against them, and just essentially meditate. And it was incredibly peaceful. And my neighbor, who has lived in the area for decades and had grown up with cattle, saw me doing this. He saw me doing it with the bull, who has horns. And so the bull, whose name is Ricky Bobby, would just kind of, he would roll over on his side and put his head in my lap, and he'd let me scratch his belly. And my neighbor was just dumbfounded by this. He said, I've never seen anything like this. So he started coming over, and then, you know, he invited his friends to come over and see it. And so kind of pretty soon we were holding cow therapy sessions.
That's amazing. And because you mentioned Ricky Bobby specifically, can you talk about how Ricky Bobby's personality influenced his name?
Yeah. So the original three, so he was the bull, and then the two cows. And so we named the two females, Lucy and Ethel, from the old TV show, I Love Lucy. And so Ricky Bobby was then Ricky. So for Ricky Ricardo. But he turned out to have this very goofy personality where you bring out the food can and you shake a little bit of food. And he was like right at the front of the line, sticking his tongue out. And so it reminded me more of the character Ricky Bobby from Talladega Nights. Ricky Bobby has several great quotes, but probably the one that's most relevant is, if you ain't first, you're last. For Ricky Bobby, the human, that was the finish line in a NASCAR race. But for Ricky Bobby, the cow, it was first in line at the feed trough.
Yes. And at this point, you've lived with these cows for about 4 years now. What surprised you about them over the years? And do you see them differently than before?
They surprise me every day. They show a level of social bonding that I haven't seen with my dogs. We have anywhere from 3 to 5 dogs at any given time. And although the dogs coexist with each other generally peacefully, I would not ever have considered them good friends. They just kind of want parental attention most of the time. And the cows genuinely seem to care for each other. I see them groom each other and how they are so bonded as a unit. Sometimes when we have to do things to take care of them, like trimming hooves, or we have to give them vaccinations and we have to take one out of the herd momentarily, that isolation is like the worst thing for them. More than any physical discomfort that they have, they cannot stand being separated from each other. And it's a testament to how social they are, but it's also kind of very touching.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk about this, and good luck with your farm.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for having me on the show again.
Dr. Gregory Burns, professor at Emory University. And you can read an excerpt of his book at sciencefriday.com/cowpuppy. After the break, what an analysis of 2.5 billion-year-old rocks tells us about the history of Earth's mantle. This is Science Friday. I'm Sophie Bushwick. If you're looking to really learn about the history of our planet, look to geology, like John McPhee's stories chronicling the formation of our continent based on the rock layers in highway road cuts. But that record has its limits. Rocks and minerals get weathered, buried, heated, melted, and recycled. So geologists search out rare, super old geologic holdouts to tell about the earliest times. Ira's here with a story of one such super old rock from the bottom of the sea.
Writing in the journal Nature, researchers describe what they can learn about the chemical history of Earth's mantle, that is the layer right beneath the planet's crust, what they can learn from studying rocks they think are at least 2.5 billion, yes, that's with a B, 2.5 billion years old. Joining me now is Dr. Elizabeth Cottrell, chair of the Department of Mineral Sciences at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. She's also curator of the National Rock Collection. Did you know we had one? And co-author of this study. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thanks. It's my pleasure to be here.
Do we have a National Rock Collection?
We do. We do have a National Rock Collection, and it's really an important part of U.S. scientific infrastructure and international scientific infrastructure. We have rocks from all over the world, and they are freely available for study to researchers around the globe. If you think about it, we often spend a lot of money to go and get rocks from exotic locations, And it makes a lot of sense to curate them and make them available for use again, rather than having to go back and recollect them.
Yeah, I know you showed me some of these great old rocks, but I don't want to get off the track here because we could easily talk about rocks, one of my favorite subjects. I want to get on the track to talk about, where do you get a 2.5 billion year old rock?
Well, the most common locations for super old rocks are on the continents. But in this case, we think we have really old rocks that have been dredged from the seafloor. So the rocks in our study come from three different locations on the seafloor. One set of rocks was actually recovered by icebreakers under the North Pole.
No kidding.
Yeah. Another set of rocks was recovered from the seafloor south of Africa, between Africa and Antarctica. And another set of rocks was recovered from the seafloor in the Pacific Ocean. So we've gone to great lengths to acquire these rocks. They're all from locations on the seafloor where the Earth's crust is spreading apart and new ocean floor, new ocean crust is being created.
Hmm. You mentioned the difficulty of getting these rocks. Are they rare? Are there a lot of them?
Well, this rock type in our study is not rare on the global scale. The mantle of our planet is about 70% of the volume of our planet. So by that metric, mantle rocks are not rare on the Earth. But finding them at the surface is difficult, and that is rare because when the mantle melts, it creates the Earth's crust. And so the crust covers up the mantle. These few settings on the planet are places where the mantle is exposed, for example, in fractures, and we can send ships out, dredge the seafloor, literally drag, you know, a bucket along the seafloor and kind of go fishing for rocks. And in these rare locations, we find pieces of the mantle.
Wow. And if you showed me one, what would it look like? I mean, does it look any different from an ordinary rock?
Well, no, probably not. They have abundant quantities of the mineral olivine. Now, you may know the mineral olivine by the trade name peridot. It's August's birthstone, green mineral. And that's the dominant mineral in this rock called peridotite, named after this olivine. But often these rocks on the seafloor, you know, they've rusted somewhat, and so they can appear weathered and orangey. They also have the minerals orthopyroxene and spinel, which may or may not be minerals that you've heard of commonly. And then deeper in the Earth's mantle, the mineral garnet replaces this mineral spinel. But peridotites with garnet are not recovered from the seafloor. So our rocks that we studied here are the minerals olivine, orthopyroxene, and spinel.
So these mantle rocks are unusual, but are these the oldest rocks around?
No, by no means. These are not likely to be the oldest rocks around, but they are likely to be older than the average mantle that circulates and is recovered from these seafloor locations.
And how do you date the rocks? How do you know just how old they are?
We don't know how old these rocks are. What I can tell you about these rocks is that they have melted to extreme extents. If you think of these rocks are the residues of creating the Earth's crust. In other words, these rocks have melted and given up their melt to create the Earth's crust. And so if you think of us wringing out a sponge and the water coming out, these rocks in our study have been squoze dry. The melt has been extracted, and it's been extracted to a large extent, an unusual extent that we infer happened under really hot conditions deep in the Earth. And those kind of temperatures are not really available today, but would have been available in the Archean Eon, billions of years ago, when the Earth was hotter.
Hmm. So what do you seek to learn from them? What can they tell you?
Our team is interested in the history of oxygen in the deep Earth. We are interested to understand how our planet evolves, how new crust forms, and the role of oxygen in that process. It's all part of this big story about how Earth has formed, how it's evolved, and how our planet has become habitable. One of the interesting things about the history of oxygen in the mantle is that the oxygen availability in these rocks governs things as basic as the gases that are emitted from volcanoes, the gases that would have formed Earth's earliest atmosphere. And so when we're thinking about planets and planetary formation and signatures of habitability, it all comes back to the rocks that make up the interiors of planets.
Mm-hmm. So these rocks, they, as you say, they melted at a very high temperature, but without doing the equivalent of rusting?
Yeah, you are bringing up a prime example of oxidation in our everyday lives. Corrosion is an example of iron oxidation. And when metal rusts, an iron atom loses an electron. This is oxidation. You're exactly right. So that is exactly what we're looking at in these samples. That's what we're analyzing. We're looking at the amounts of oxidized iron and reduced iron to tell us something about how active oxygen was in the mantle in these ancient times. So it tells us something about how the composition of the Earth's mantle has evolved, or in this case, we're suggesting that it hasn't evolved so much and that this chemical signature is generated simply by the natural process of the planet cooling rather than by some other process that could have changed its chemical composition.
It's sort of the Earth just doesn't make rocks like it used to.
That is the best way to say it.
How do you go further with this? Do you have to find more rocks, or is this a thing you can follow up on in the lab?
This is something that we can follow up both by analyzing more rocks. It's always good in any science to reproduce results and test additional hypotheses. But we are definitely following up with laboratory work. In our lab, we can create conditions such as are found in the deep Earth. We can create very high pressures and very high temperatures, and we can melt rocks in the lab and study the chemistry of that melting process under different conditions of oxygen availability, under different temperature conditions, and under different pressures. So my group is particularly interested in following up on laboratory experiments to help us understand the rock record.
What would be the take-home lesson that you learned from the discovery of these rare old rocks?
The take-home message of our study is that we may be able to produce these really unusual chemistries in this type of rock by changing the temperature and pressure at which they melted, and not by changing the bulk composition of the rock. And that is really important because it really helps us as Earth scientists to eliminate or to support entire classes of models about how the planet formed and has evolved for these billions of years, and how the atmosphere has evolved, and how the interior of the planet has linked to planetary habitability.
Well, Dr. Cottrell, I could talk about rocks forever because I love talking about them and looking at them. So I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks. It was so much fun. I'm thrilled to be here.
Dr. Elizabeth Cottrell, Chair of the Department of Mineral Sciences at the famous Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History. She's also curator of the National Rock Collection.
We know trees play a big role in the fight against climate change. They soak up carbon dioxide from the air and store it for centuries in the form of biomass. But it turns out that trees could be doing even more. Last year, Science Friday covered how the company Living Carbon had genetically engineered poplar trees to grow twice as fast and store 30% more carbon than regular poplars. Now, researchers at the University of Maryland have also dabbled in genetically modifying poplar trees, but they have a different goal. They're aiming to make the wood stronger so it can be turned into lumber without the need for harsh chemical processing. This modification also helps the wood last longer without deteriorating, which lets the trees store carbon for longer periods of time. Joining me to talk about this superwood is the lead plant geneticist of the study, Dr. Yiping Qi, associate professor at the Department of Plant Science and Landscape Architecture at the University of Maryland. Welcome to Science Friday. Thank you so much for joining us.
Nice to meet you, Sophie.
Let's get into this superwood. What is it, and how do you genetically engineer trees to produce it?
Sure, yeah, I just want to give you a little bit of background information. So a few years back, my colleague, Dr. Liang Binghu, in the engineering college, he actually published a paper in Nature reporting engineering of super strong wood using chemical treatment. So after chatting with him, so we kind of inspired to seek another more sustainable way, which is rather than using chemical to remove certain lignin in the wood material, we will genetically engineer the wood by editing one gene called FOCA1 in this case.
Just one gene?
Yeah, just one gene, because this gene is a kind of is coding for enzyme involved in lignin biosynthesis pathway. So if we knock out this gene, we're going to affect this pathway. The plant, the tree, will make less lignin. So this is our hypothesis. So my lab is really good at genetic engineering and genome editing. So we just apply a technique called base editing to knock out this FOCA1 gene specifically. In this case, it's poplar tree. So where we found that we can reduce about 13% of lignin content in poplar tree. And this is a level typically Dr. Hu's lab is going to be using chemical to remove this amount of lignin for engineering super strong wood. And then we went ahead to do the similar processing yet without doing any chemical treatment.
So wait, what is lignin? What does it normally do, and why does taking it out make the wood better?
That's a very good question. So lignin actually is essentially one major part of the secondary sort of cell wall material from our wood, any wood material, any trees. You'll find them there. Different tree variety have different content. And they actually play an important role for structure and also filling the open space in the cell wall. But because different trees have different level lignin, because many processing of wood requires removal of lignin, so it's kind of necessary to do lignin removal using chemicals when we're processing wood, such as engineering super strong wood.
And when you take it out, you've found that the wood is stronger, but also you've mentioned that it stores extra carbon dioxide. How does that work? Why is the superwood better at trapping CO2?
So the idea behind this carbon sequestration is many of the, you know, we grow forests, we grow lumbers, and we use the lumber to do building construction and other materials. And the super strong wood is a promising sort of material because it further engineered from natural wood. Because of that, this wood is very strong and can resist to a lot of deterioration environment, can hence last much longer. So if we can have wood engineered stay there for much longer time without being sort of like degraded, going releasing CO2 back to the atmosphere. So in this case, we consider we have another way to really retain the sort of fixed CO2 in the wood material. So in this way, we can sequester more carbon over time.
And you've done this genetic modification in poplar trees. Why did you choose to work with this kind of tree?
Yeah, very good question. So poplar tree is one of the major sort of research target or plant species we are using to understand a tree and also material. It is really, it can grow pretty well in the temperate environment in northern atmosphere, not necessarily in the very hot environment where pine can thrive. So the real reason using poplar is really for us to sort of using it as a model tree system so that because it is amenable for genetic transformation, so that scientists like me, our lab, can really work on them to modify genes rapidly to create the genome engineered trees and assess their property. So with engineer like Dr. Hu. So this is really a model system. So once we have found that something is working in this case, we can expand to other tree species.
And what do you see as the ultimate goal of this line of research?
First of all, this research we just published is really just a proof concept. And ultimately, what we want to do, we would actually expand this approach, this concept to the tree, which are more relevant for us to use building material like pines, for example. So if we can do that, and then I think that will be economically, that will be a lot of potential there. So this is really one major step for us to, you know, have this result. And we're excited to really explore in other trees by applying similar technologies.
Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Yiping Qi, Associate Professor at the Department of Plant Science and Landscape Architecture at the University of Maryland. Thank you so much for listening. That wraps up this week's show. If you missed any part of this program or would like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts. You can also join us throughout the week on social media or with our newsletters. You can find those at sciencefriday.com/newsletters. Have a great weekend. I'm Sophie Bushwick.